Support for this homegrown special comes from a generous contribution from Irene and Jack Stewart.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we're back for a another monthly broadcast.
Monthly visit.
Yep. And we've got a good lineup today. Lots to get to, actually.
We're good at what we do.
We are good at what we do. And our guests are good at what they do as well. We're going to talk with Mary Courtney. Mary and her husband Shane are Courtney Farms out in Baghdad, Kentucky. And they're growing a variety, I think like 100 different types of vegetables this year out at their farm. They supply some local grocers and do CSA, that sort of thing. I'm going to be collaborating with her a little bit. So I wanted to kind of bring her story to everybody because I think it's an interesting one.
Oh, yeah.
As the face of the family farm really is beginning to change in Kentucky. So
yeah, I admire her enthusiasm and her understanding that it's going to be a long uphill row here, so to speak, to get this thing done. But
and creative thinking, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's coming up here in a little bit. And then we're going to do a little road trip and visit Bob Richardson.
Yeah, and his wife, Mary Ann, they live in a house built by his grandfather in the 1890s, the edge of Anchorage. And it's a wonderfully stuffed house full of antiques. And he's taken the garden the next step. It's kind of a southern estate garden, but it's got a welcoming flavor to it.
It really does, and they're just charming, sweet people.
Yeah, it was a fun interview and probably the nicest house I've been in a long time.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah.
All right, and then we'll top it all off with finding out a little bit about Love Louisville Trees Contest. Yep. The guys from Limewalker Tree Service are going to come in. Basically, the concept is to bring some positive attention to some of the fabulous trees that we have in Louisville. I think we take it all for granted because we're so used to such a lush sort of environment.
Yeah.
But other places apparently are, you know, more impressed than we are with what we have. So Limewalker, they're trying to bring some attention to that.
Yeah, take a picture of your favorite tree and put it on Facebook and
see if you win.
So you too can win overnight in a 40-foot tree, if you
want. We'll find out what the winner gets. That'll be coming up in part three. So, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
There was standing water for quite a bit. I mean,
no kidding.
Really, it's been an issue this year. I've lost a Japanese maple about 15 or 20 years old, a big, beautiful tree. And I just wonder, and I've also got some lilacs and viburnums down along the edge of the driveway that were underwater for 2 weeks.
Okay.
The bottom of them.
Yeah.
And they really look hurting. Yeah. One's dead and two are very unhappy. So.
Well, and such a swing, too, because if you think about last summer and the drought conditions.
Yeah, and then this.
If plants were at a disadvantage from that, then they drowned for 2 weeks. Yeah.
And the one silver lining is the hostas are just incredible. If there's ever a lesson in watering your hostas early, my God, they're just booming.
Things are pretty lush.
So I got one dead, two dying, and something booming. Sounds like spring at Hidden Hill.
No kidding.
Yeah, how about the Wishes Stay?
Well, the same thing. It's like it's interesting to see what thrives and what doesn't under very stressful conditions.
Right.
A lot of, like in the areas that are not very well drained in the perennial beds, don't be surprised if you see some yellowing and some stunting of some of your plants just because of too much water.
Exactly.
And it's not necessarily too much water. It's like a lack of oxygen. You know what I mean? That is killing the plant because it can't take in water if it doesn't have any oxygen.
Yeah, in fact, a guy called me today and he had 30 knockout roses 5 or 6 feet tall and they've been dying on them one by one. He wonders what's going on.
Uh-huh.
I mean, water must be a factor in there somewhere.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
Yeah. So, a lot of rain, not so great for your plants, and definitely hasn't been great for, I know, Mary Courtney, who's going to be joining us here shortly, because they basically just started to be able to plant stuff in the last week because of too much rain and can't get out there. So it's been hard on our gardens, but it's also been hard on our farmers as well. So keep that in mind when it comes to the prices of things, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's not just hurting the perennial beds. So
we,
Bob,
shall survive.
Yes, we shall. What's going on around town?
All kinds of stuff. There's the Whitehall Peony Fest on Monday, May 16th. Roy Clem's coming into town. He's one of the great peony grooves of all time. The Glenview Garden Club's having its two-day tour June 4th and 5th. The Blooming Bardstown Garden Tour and the Marketplace will be June 11th. And then Margaret Shea will be at Hidden Hill Nursery to talk about native plants. Margaret of Drop Seed Nursery speaking at 1 o'clock on May 21st, but she'll be there all day talking about native plants and native seeds and so forth.
And Margaret's Margaret's good.
Yeah.
Also, May 21st is the Bloomfest at Bernheim, if you're headed the other direction. That's 10 to 4, so always a good
one. Must be spring.
Must be spring. All right, it is spring, and it's been a wet one, and I've been following the farming practices of the Courtneys out in Bagdad, Kentucky, and Mary Courtney is joining us today to talk a little bit about what they're doing out there. I think some innovative thinking. Courtney Farms operates on several different levels. They have a traditional sort of vegetable CSA that sells directly to the consumer, and then they also sell vegetables to local grocery stores like Fresh Market, Whole Foods, that sort of thing. But we'll get the rundown from Mary. She's joining us now. Mary, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for taking some time out. I know it's a busy time of the year for you guys.
Well, Janine and Bob, thank you guys for including me on the show. It's really exciting to be a part of what you're doing here.
Great, thank you. I met Mary through Sarah Fritchner and this whole sort of like local food movement. So just to, full disclosure, Mary and I are going to sort of collaborate with some things this season. As I said, they concentrate on vegetables, and we'll talk about how all this works, but I'll be selling eggs and fruit through her CSA. So she's helping me while I'm helping her. And I think that's kind of what we want to talk about today, is the changing face of our local agricultural scene. You know, we talk about local food, but who's really producing it, and how are we getting rid of the obstacles that used to exist to connect the farmer to the consumer? So I think Mary's a great spokesperson for what's going on. So I appreciate her taking the time to be with us. But Mary, first give us an idea of the scope of your farm and what you all do.
Okay. Well, and Janine was right in your introduction there. We have ventured into produce, actually. Last summer was our first summer doing it on a scale other than just having the garden and sharing it with friends. Shane and I have been traditional farmers. We're in our early 30s, and we set out thinking we were going to be able to make some long-term mortgage payments on tobacco. And in Kentucky, that industry that has really been the bread and butter for so many of us farm families is kind of on shaky ground now. So because of it being fragile, we decided that we needed to really start looking at diversifying our operation. Produce seemed to be a wonderful fit because it's something that we have both always enjoyed on our own and in our childhood families. And it just seemed to be a great fit with us being pretty close to Louisville and it being more of an urban area, not that many people still depend on their own backyard for the garden. So we thought we could help meet the needs of people in the more urban areas while meeting the needs of us who want to be able to stay a family farm. We have Lucas and Ellie, who are 3 and 1 right now, and we want to be able to secure a family farm for them that if they want to come back to and farm, that it'll still be here when they go off to college and maybe want to come back. We learned the value, I think, of diversification as far as our farm enterprises, but we took it to another level, and we needed to diversify not only what we raise, but how we disperse what we raise.
Because mm-hmm. that's the thing that's starting to change that I think is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same family farm that it used to be.
No, it's not. And as much as I loved and enjoyed farming with my parents growing up, and my dad, he still full-time farms, but I know that if I want to be where my dad is at his age, then I have to make every single decision on our family farm in a business mind instead of just a farm set mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, can you give us a sense of how many acres of the 90 acres you use for produce and what you're going to be growing?
Yeah, sure, I'd like to. And I'll tell you this might be a little bit interesting. Last year, we had about 25 more or less acres in actual produce production. Hindsight's 2020, but it was quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
But we didn't know what would work, what we would be able to grow well, and we knew we had to give it our best shot. So we did that, and we're hoping to really learn from a lot of the things that we did right and even improve on those, and then really learn from the things that we didn't do right.
Well, what'd you grow last year, for instance, that didn't work out?
Well, for instance, we had carrots that ended up being a flop.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's understandable. I'm just our listeners want to know what you were doing and where you're evolving to, I think.
Yeah, and then last year we grew, for example, one of our routes was we grew a lot of a particular type of bell pepper for a particular market that, for a multitude of reasons, just didn't pan out for us financially. So this year we've learned from that and we're not going that route. I mean, we raise everything here from cold crops, lettuces, onions, a lot of root crops, your tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, on into melons, corn, potatoes. I'm really trying to pair up what we grow with the markets that I feel comfortable where we can sell.
So what markets are you in? We mentioned this traditional CSA, the community sort of supported agriculture model. Mm-hmm. So explain that, and then the other ways in which you sell your product.
Okay. Our CSA, and for those folks that aren't familiar with that, the CSA is Community Supported Agriculture. What we do with our CSA is, say a family doesn't have a garden of their own, but they'd love to have the rewards of having a garden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can pair up with them. They pay basically a flat fee, and they get to decide. We have three different share sizes that they can choose from. And then that family would sign up. They'd pay a fee to be involved with us for a season. And our season is 22 weeks long, is what we put out as a commitment to them, that we'll supply you with at least 22 weeks of produce. And so then once we start harvesting, each week we will get them produce. And it's basically a sampling of what we have here on our farm.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime that we're able to shorten that food chain mm-hmm. between our field and their dinner table, then you know more of that money gets to stay with the farm and the farm workers. But also, I feel it's very valuable to let people be able to reconnect with where their food came from, how it was grown, get to come see it if they want, know the folks, and make it a real experience.
And people are much more interested in that experience today than ever before.
We did an end of the season customer survey with our CSA folks last year, and it was quite unified in them letting us know that them hearing our recipes from our family and them getting to know what was coming up and how we did what. We actually got more comments and more feedback on that than we did
the food.
The
product,
you know,
they enjoyed the quality of the connecting with the people.
Right.
Yeah, I keep going back to the practical end of this because I worked on farms as a kid from the seat of a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
You're not doing this from the seat of a tractor. Doesn't sound like you guys are out there. Just the two of you out there hoeing and mm-hmm. planting and harvesting. Mm-hmm. How does this work?
Well, no, I'm glad you answered that. And to be quite frank, I've been sitting on a tractor all morning. My arms are officially sunburned now, and my hands are covered in grease. There's no way physically that Shane and I could do what we do on our own. We also still raise tobacco and still have some grain crops also.
Okay.
So we have a lot going on at once. And so we do have to hire other folks. And we work with the U.S. Department of Labor, and we actually employ 10 migrant workers. They actually mm-hmm. are all... they're either friends or family of each other, and they all originate from Veracruz, Mexico. They'll come in on work visas. We provide them housing and transportation. It's very expensive, and the Department of Labor regulates what we pay them and all the rules about it. But they're wonderful workers and very dependable.
Well, I understand that, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then actually this year, Shane and I made the decision, an investment, just like a piece of equipment, but there's two young individuals that we hired on to be able to help us kind of execute a lot through the day, because this is part of it that I'm learning. The more that we do, the more it's spreading, Shane and I, like more thinner and thinner.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so we have asked, you know, we've hired some additional help, and it's been great. It's great. It's been great having them.
So all of this is well and good, right? But we have to have somebody on the other end that wants to buy it from you.
Exactly.
And you've come up, I think, with some creative ways in which to address kind of the CSA model to take it one step further.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also selling what to Whole Foods, directly to Whole Foods and to some of the fresh markets and some other sections of the industry, right?
Right. Yeah, we try, and this is all part of that diversification.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried to, I I guess, introduce our products and introduce our family farm to as many folks as I can that appreciate and value it being local.
Mm-hmm.
In order for me to be able to justify making a trip into Louisville, I have to be able to bring in quite a bit of produce. So that works well with us working with grocery stores, or there's a couple of distributors in town that serve hospitals and universities and private and public schools. I mean, Jefferson County Public School, for instance, they're going to be buying a lot of produce from us this summer.
Okay.
More people that are aware of the need to support local farmers and who value that, I'm trying to be able to introduce ourselves to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we've gotten creative in with our CSA, taking it one step further from what I was talking about a few minutes ago, where folks pay an upfront fee and each week in exchange for that get a harvest of our share. We have created, it's kind of like a virtual farmer's market. People can go to our website and they can actually go in and place an order of items from our farm that we're growing. But in addition to this, and this is how Janine and I started working together, in order to help justify us being able to do this and offer a lot of items, we're now collaborating with other local farmers, which has a huge ripple effect to be able to offer their products to these same folks.
What's a typical fee for someone to pay for a week's worth of groceries?
Okay, if they were going to subscribe to the actual CSA, mm-hmm. where we would get to pick what goes in their share and we choose the quantities, the small share, we call the planting share, it's $410 for a 22-week season. And then if you go up on the higher end, if you've got a larger family, it's up to $625 a season. But if you break that down on a per-week basis, I challenge folks to go to the supermarket.
Right. Okay, especially now.
Yeah.
Good grief.
I'm
still
in the ice cream department on that kind of
So they would get this, and I think part of like eliminating some of the things that people have sometimes felt uncomfortable about with the CSA is that they kind of get a surprise box of food, right? They don't know exactly what they're going to get. So with this additional sort of a la carte virtual experience, they can sort of have a little bit more control. You're going to pay additional because you're paying for each thing that you want to order, but you have a more diverse selection of what you want to consume in any given week while still supporting the family farm. So if you got Mary's CSA and you wanted some eggs, you could say, please send some eggs, and then those would come from me. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of that virtual experience that ends up supporting everybody. Right. And then the consumer gets the variety that they want otherwise.
Do you deliver, or they come pick it up at a point? How does that work?
We're through Shelby County and Jefferson County. We are working on, we haven't finalized all of our what our route will be yet, but we'll have several locations where we'll actually deliver it at a public location where folks can come and pick it up. Or we've even had the, I almost think it's a luxury, we've had the luxury of being able to hook up with some places of employment, and they have actually embraced the idea because it fits so well in employers'
right.
health and wellness program that we can actually deliver it to their work.
Huh. Is there a local role model for this? Anybody else doing this already that you guys kind of look at and depend upon for help and so forth?
I think Mary's it.
Well, it's lonely at the top.
That's right. We got her on the radio first.
Wow.
Let's just hope it works out great, and then maybe more folks will want to do the same.
She's our model, Bob.
Wow.
No, really, I think that this is what struck me as, you know, radio worthy, because it's a very innovative way of solving some of those. You know, we've been, for 10 years, we've talked about community-supported agriculture on homegrown. And we've additionally talked to people that have talked about how difficult it is to get your product directly to the consumer and, you know, all the problems that exist with moving local food around. And here's an innovative solution to some of those. So the problems are not there anymore. When young people start to not think the old way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And well,
that's
I'll say
what Courtney
that, you know,
Farms doing.
I guess it's when you're in a situation, this is what I was taught from my parents, I guess, and it's part of being grown up on a farm that, you know, where there's a will, there's a way.
Mm-hmm.
And when we set our mind to raise this this vegetable crop and to make it work. And last year, you know, I had said that we tried so many different ways to sell things, and some worked and some didn't. And as wonderful as your regular farmers markets are, it was a real challenge for me to balance that and being a mother.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And, you know, I have two very young children. And so, but I have such respect and value for folks that see the value in supporting farmers like myself. So I wanted to stay in touch with that. And then I wanted more of that food dollar to stay mm-hmm. back on our farm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where brains got. You know, our wheels got spinning, and Sarah Frischner, through the Farm to Table program, she's been instrumental in helping us kind of make some connections to get this up and going, and I think it's going to be great. We actually, and Janine and I haven't even shared this with you, we've just got our website up and going now.
Good, great.
And so I think that, and that's another piece, that's another huge, in my mind, change of the face of agriculture.
Right.
You know, if we don't tell our story, who's going to?
Yeah.
Has customer base increased from this year, from last year to this year?
Yes, it has, both in our CSA and, like, for instance, last year, you know, we sold at the two grocery stores in Louisville, and actually both of those now we get the opportunity to work with in Lexington, too. So, yeah, and then we've increased with some of the distributors, so... And that's where we're hope is, you know, focus on those things that work and do that.
So what's your first delivery date? Do you have one in mind?
Well, because of the rains, we had actually, ideally, we would have started this week, but the rains have really set all that back.
Yeah.
I'm striving for the third, or the week of the 23rd.
Okay.
Either that week or possibly the last last week of May, which happens to be the first week.
It'll be like lettuce and...
Yeah, we'll have lettuces, green onions. Pretty soon we'll have peas and beets.
When's the sweet corn? That's the big one, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, last year it was great. Last year we got to have sweet corn before the 4th of July.
There you go.
This year it'll be after.
Yeah, I think this year it'll be after.
Well, that's a lesson in and of itself, too, right?
You're right.
Being a part of a CSA teaches you that it doesn't happen on one specific date because the weather has definitely jammed us up a little bit this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, and we try to teach people that the value of eating seasonally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when regardless of when you get your sweet corn, it's going to be great.
So yeah, there you go.
We might be salivating longer.
So one more question, Mary. How do people find you? You said that the website's up and going. What's the website?
Yeah, the website is www.CourtneyFarmsCSA.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Mary. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Mary Courtney and her husband, Shane, operate Courtney Farm in Bagdad, Kentucky. You can find their produce at Whole Foods and Fresh Market in Louisville or become a member of their CSA for the season. 22 weeks of farm fresh local food from Bagdad, Kentucky. Shelby County, my neck of the woods.
Yeah, boy.
All right. Thanks, Mary.
Coming up next, we visit an antique home and an antique and southern garden near Anchorage, Kentucky. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And Miss Wishy, we are just in a wonderful kitchen.
We really are.
At the home of Bob and Marianne Richardson. Live off Lakeland Road at the edge of Anchorage in a marvelous antiques-filled house built around 1900 by his grandfather, a house that once served as a general store in what was nearby Lakeland area and also catered to the patients at the nearby Central State Hospital. And as we're going to find out, I've never been to a house that more fit the garden and what the philosophy of melding house and garden in this place does.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a neat place.
There's a sense of... I mean, certainly we're in the here and now, but there's such a sense of history that you don't often find when you enter into someone's home.
There's also a ghost really cool. tour. We're going to find out about that.
All right, too, yeah. Good. You all didn't tell me about that on the pre-tour.
Well, enough about us. Bob Richardson, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob. Glad to have both of you here.
Thanks.
Before we get into your garden, let's talk about your house and the carriage house behind it and the history of the place that kind of sets the stage for your marvelous garden here in Lakeland.
Well, my grandfather built the house in 1890. He had a small general store here, and then as his business improved, he enlarged the store. He had a contract with the state for all their goods, and the patients' families would put money on account with us, and we would send runners twice a day with over 100 orders to each of these patients, and that lasted until about 1965.
Wow, that's a long time. It's a good business, too, in terms of that built-in sort of customer base with Central State. It's ingenious.
That's right. He was Swiss, of Swiss heritage, let's put it that way. Uh-huh. And I think he had a good business mind.
Awesome.
And there was also some gardens over there that might have just piqued your interest in gardening at a very early age. Talk about the old hospital and what it was like and what the gardens were like over there before we talk about your garden.
Oh, the hospital gardens were beautiful. They had formal gardens in the front and fish pond, a huge fish pond, and roses and all kinds of iris beds. And the patients would take care of those beds. And it was part of a work therapy mm-hmm. program. And they were way ahead of their time because this hospital was built in 1873, right after the Civil War. So it gave them a purpose, and rather than just sitting on the wards and rocking away.
So, Bob, how much time did you spend here growing up?
Well, I came back here when I was about 10 years old,
okay.
And the family had owned it all these years, and I was in and out all this time, and then I moved in 74, 75, okay. Because the family was getting too old, and they
sure.
were popping off, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you mentioned, we were talking earlier, that the house, nobody's ever said it better, the house tells you what to put in the garden. Explain that philosophy.
I believe the house, any house, I tell people, don't change things too fast when you move into an old house, because the house has a vocabulary all of its own. It tells you what to do. You wonder why they put a door here or this, that, and the mm-hmm. other. You find out as you go along there was a very good reason they did it. And the garden's the same way. I believe a garden piques your interest and tells you what to do, and you have to. It's a very creative thing, and it's more like a painting. I think gardens, thinking in terms of painting as far as gardens are concerned, in design and color combinations.
And I think, too, the way that the garden directs you through its space as well is very much that. So as we toured the garden, you really only had so many options. Do you know what
That's
I mean?
That's correct. That's right.
So, in terms of where you went. So mm-hmm. it's specific in that way. Yeah. So that's going to tell you a little bit about how you need to reveal
what's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, most people don't know this is here because you can't see it from the street. Mm-hmm. But the garden does talk to you. At least I believe it does.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, if they listen.
And just sitting there looking out the window, the kitchen window, let's talk with the hardscape, the red bricks, and the pathways that so just nicely blend and lead you into this garden.
Yes, I had an elderly brick mason by the name of James Harris. Did a wonderful job and is still doing it, and he would work with me, and I'd say, James, we need this a little wider here, and he'd say, okay, and he would work with you. He didn't just do it the way he wanted to, but he did it in the old way to make it look old,
mm-hmm.
and because you don't want a modern thing around this older house.
Mm-hmm. So how much of the garden, when you moved here in the 70s, how much of the garden as we know it today existed?
Almost none.
Okay. that's remarkable to me, really, because it has an old presence to it.
We worked on that.
You know?
Yeah. And when my grandfather was alive, it was enclosed with a privet hedge. And, you
mm-hmm.
know, that has to be cut every other day. And they had a gardener who did that. When I moved in, it had been overgrown with mulberry bushes and so forth. So I had that bulldozed out and started from scratch.
Okay.
So there wasn't a great deal here. A few plants, but not many.
Okay, so let's talk about some. You talked about your brick, because that has a very sort of old way about it as well, I think. Old appeal to it, or, you know, more of an antique appeal to it. But there are other features in the garden that would be considered hardscape features. So
yes.
Like fountains and ponds and that sort
right.
of thing. Where did you acquire those? Because most of those have a very, you know, historic feel to them as well.
Well, I believe a garden has to have bones. You have to have structure. And the hardscape is part of that, the fountains and all, as well as trees and different things. But we got, when Marianne and I would travel, we would get things in Charleston or wherever we happened to see one. We scour the countryside.
So they were antique somewhere
along the line.
Okay, and then there were, you teased me, and of course I'm gullible enough to believe you, that you shipped in some columns from Greece. So you've actually manufactured some pieces yourself.
Oh,
tell
yes.
us a little bit about the columns that you made.
I took garbage cans and put a column in the center so it wouldn't be as heavy. Mm-hmm. And you take a third perlite, a third mulch, and a third concrete, mix it all together, pour it in, and let it set, of course. And then you
uncast
hope for
it.
The best and uncast. And they
look really cool.
Did you like those?
Because they look really old and, you know, like you could have had them shipped in from Greece.
Well, I kid people with that.
Least Sellersburg.
Yeah, Sellersburg. But, you know, there have been some wonderful people that have helped me in the garden. They've Craig Hubbock is one. He has these daily desk job, but he loves to come out. He's a friend of the family. Mm-hmm. He loves to come out and work with us on the weekends. So we really enjoy that.
Yeah.
And speaking of help, we can't leave Marianne out of this. I know you've got a Southern Magnolia out there, and she's from Nashville. So was she part of the planning process also?
Oh, of course she was.
Approval process,
Approval process. And she's also the chief deadheader.
Okay.
But if Craig and I decide, well, this looks pretty good the way we've got this in here, Marianne will come out and she'll say, well, don't you think it ought to be a little to the left or a little this way? And she's usually right.
And what adds to the flavor in the back, there's an old carriage house that you hadn't moved in. Tell us that story.
Well, the old carriage house was part of the superintendent's mansion at the old Central State Hospital, and it goes back to about 1890 as well. I was working outside one day, and it had been abandoned for a while, and I saw people working on it, and I walked over, and I said, oh, you're restoring it. And he said, no, we're tearing it down. Well, I'm a preservationist at heart. I couldn't stand it. So I tried to have him sell me the entire building. Well, he would only sell me the carriage house.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that moved, because our carriage house had burned a number of years ago. So when they moved it, the mover gave me a particular price, and after it was all over, he said, if I'd have known how heavy this was, I'd have never given you that price. Well, it turned out it has vertical sheeting as well as horizontal sheeting. They call it hurricane sheeting.
Okay.
So it doubles the weight. Mm-hmm. And so I think he lost money and went out of business after that.
So it's a hardy structure.
It is. It's just like a rock.
Wow.
Just to give our listeners a sense of what's out there, it was a couple acres out there?
Mm-hmm, about 2 acres.
And you've got oak leaf, Japanese maples, big Japanese maples, English ivy, hostas, poppies, a lot of ground cover, pachysandra, a pagoda tree that may have had its last spring this year, unfortunately, and some red buds and some taxus and a bunch of things. It just gives it that estate feel. How did you pick these out?
Well, I picked them out by color and texture and balancing textures against textures, greens against greens, light greens against dark greens, and rough texture against fine texture, shiny leaf against matte finish, and tried to mask my color so that it doesn't seem to be a hodgepodge of everything. When I was young, I went back to university and studied art, and I found that the garden is like a palette in when you're doing a painting. And so it's all design and color. So I used those criteria to design the garden.
I think that's really well articulated, because Bob said it has the estate garden feel to it. And that's precisely what it is it amassing, you know, certain textures or colors as opposed to mixing a whole bunch of craziness together. Yeah. So it gives it that quote-unquote estate garden, that more refined garden presence. And it's so lush, too. And, like, it's very there's a very southern appeal to it somehow.
Oh, good, because that's what Marianne and I like. We love Charleston.
Mm-hmm. And, I think that shows, sure, that influence shows very much if you've had a chance to experience some of those southern estate gardens.
You know, I see people who have try to make gardens, and they throw everything together, and it there's no impact if you don't put different manage your colors. Mm-hmm. Now, it works on a cottage garden, something like that, but in an estate kind of mm-hmm. garden, I don't think it works as
sort
well.
Sort of like single space versus double space. Mm-hmm. You need your eyes to be able to move to the next line in a more gracious sort of way. Especially as we get older, right?
yeah, exactly. It's not like a crazy quilt.
Right.
And I just saw a horse and carriage go by. Is that part of the Charlestown influence here?
Yeah, we hired them to do that. There's a lady up the street who has carriages, horse carriages, and she comes through here occasionally.
So do you have sights on some new little garden rooms?
Well, actually, I'm running out of land.
Okay.
But a friend of ours lives across the lake in Anchorage, and I told her the other night, I'm headed to you, Lois, because that's the only pathway I've got left, except Papa John's. I've got to circumvent him
right.
to get over
that
there.
That may be difficult.
You can't see a big pizza in your backyard anywhere?
No. No pizzas.
Well, Bob and Mary Ann, it's been terrific being out here. It is just a joy to see this house and the garden and how well you've spent the last 30 years.
Oh, well, we appreciate you coming and looking at it. We love to show it to people, and we appreciate it when they enjoy it.
Great, thank you.
Because that's what a garden's for.
That's right. And a very welcoming home to boot.
Thank you.
Bob and Mary Ann Richardson live in a 1900s home along Lakeland Road near Anchorage, Kentucky. For pictures of the house or information on the house, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we have a chapter in Bob's plant stories and find out about Love Louisville Trees Contest and, of course, listeners' questions. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Miss Wishy, I see two guys and a small tree next door. Does that mean anything in particular? Or?
I know, and they're already cracking me up.
What's going on here?
We wanted to get an update on this project called Love Louisville Trees Contest.
Yeah.
And Corey Petrie and Chris O'Brien are in the studios with us. They're both arborists from Limewalker Tree Service. And it's more than just a photo contest. So we wanted to find out where this Love Louisville Trees is going to get us.
They checked their chainsaws at the door, so we're safe as far as we know.
That's
chainsaws
right.
Chainsaws only.
Yeah. So, yeah, you guys, welcome to the show. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Sure. So, Corey, tell us what the premise of Love Louisville Trees is.
Well, Love Louisville Trees, it's a grassroots campaign that we had the idea to start basically just to grow an appreciation for the trees of Louisville.
Okay.
Louisville has a lot of really fantastic trees. One of the things that actually we do at Limewalker is we have visiting arborists come in from around the world. People from New Zealand, Josephine Hedger, who you mm-hmm. interviewed last fall from the UK. And one of the things that we continually hear from them is their comments on how massive some of the trees are.
So they're
Louisville.
Impressed when they come to the area.
And
yeah.
that's one of the reasons that they come here. They okay. come to visit the States and to work with other arborists, but they come to Louisville to work with us because of the sizable trees that we have.
So Love Louisville Trees, it's on Facebook right now.
It is.
So tell us what people need to do if they want to. I mean, seriously, we take all of these great trees for granted, right? Because we're from here. So
we do, yeah.
So if you've got a favorite tree, what do you do to get it out there?
Well, the first thing they would do is if you're not a Facebook member, they'd have to join Facebook and go to the Love Louisville Trees page on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could also find that by going to www.lovelouisvilletrees.com. On the left side of the page, there's a button that says Contests, and they can click on that to find out more about the contest. Mm-hmm. They can submit a photo, and it doesn't have to be a massive tree. It doesn't have to be, you know, a 100-plus-foot-tall a poplar tree. It could be the dogwood in their backyard. It could be Harry Lauder's walking stick. Mm-hmm. You know, really just whatever their favorite tree is.
Mm-hmm. So the photos then put on the Facebook page?
The photos will be put on the Facebook page. The contest closes on May 19th. At that point, Chris and I will select the top 10 finalists.
Okay.
After that, that'll be put out for a public vote. You know, the people who are involved in the contest will be able to vote on their favorite. Mm-hmm. And that winner will win a tree climbing experience.
Cool.
And an overnight in a tree, mm-hmm. facilitated by several of Limwalker's climbing arborists. So
that'll
they won't
be
alone.
And I'll tell you, these guys are fun, so so it'll be a good experience
all
around.
You can also just be 2 feet off the ground if you so prefer.
Right? That's right. Thank you.
Yeah,
you don't have to. If it's within their constitution to sleep 50 feet off the ground, that's great. But we can rig the tree boat more commonly called maybe a hammock, we could rig it at any point in the tree.
Okay. So, I mean, this isn't just a gimmick for, you know, oh, I love this tree in my backyard. What's mm-hmm. what's kind of the overall goal of doing something like this as, you know, two professional arborists?
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do with Love the Luba Trees was to create a forum that people could really come to and talk about trees of Louisville and maybe even get a sense of what an asset that we have here. You know, we went through the ice storm and the wind storm, and we heard a lot of negative feedback about our trees. And we wanted to become, you know, create a positive feeling around trees.
Uh-huh. And other entrants may get a free tree out of this, maybe the second or third place.
That's right. Thank you. So at random, there will be another winner chosen, mm-hmm. and that individual will win the tree planting.
Okay. Sounds good.
30 years later, they can sleep in it.
Right.
<You know. laughs> So today is May 15th. So get your photos of your favorite Louisville tree in to the site, and maybe you can win and hang out with Limwalker and learn how to climb a tree and sleep in one, too.
I'd be about 18 inches above the ground.
Yeah.
With a maker's mark in one hand.
Yeah, probably.
We can't put that. Yeah, we can't advertise that.
I can.
All right, you guys. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Chris O'Brien and Corey Petrie, arborist with Limwalker Tree Service, and Love Louisville Trees Contest. So check it out.
Okay, Ms. Wishy, we're going to transit from funny guys climbing trees to some serious questions about plants.
This one's from Velvet. She says in one of her flower beds, she's got 5 knockout roses, and there's one that's not looking so great. It looks like an alien plant. Uh-oh. And has a short, strange appearance, like a bushy evergreen tree or bizarre bonsai tree.
I'm laughing with her.
Upon closer inspection, it appears that the entire bush is covered in small avocado green covered leaves and multiples all over the plant. I see no buds at all. What's wrong with this plant, and can I do anything to help it?
Sounds like something just genetically when backfired here.
It sounds like witch's broom to me.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Which is like a viral infection, if you will.
Yeah, right.
It, the scientists believe that it's transferred by insects. Like they're the vector, right?
They can be neat too.
And then,
some trees and bushes are kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. But it gets in the vascular system of the plant and never really goes away.
Right.
So the recommendation is to shovel prune it. You can prune it back really hard and see what happens, but likely and that's what I would do first, but likely the witch's broom will return. So it's better to kind of get it out of there. As opposed to leaving it there.
Put it in a key spot and invite the neighbors over. Okay, a guy named Robert's got this one, so I got to ask you this one. Over the weekend, I planted 2 small basil plants. Within 24 hours, they had small holes in the leaves. Portions of some leaves were eaten off and black spots on some of the leaves. What gives?
Well, probably if this question came in when it was still really rainy mm-hmm. and cool, and black spots on the leaves, I would say, is a bacterial leaf spot, which is not uncommon on basil. And then the portions of the leaves being eaten, slugs like anything, right?
Yeah.
And if it's cool and wet, they're going to be all over stuff. And another thing, too, to note about basil loves it hot.
Oh.
And if you put this plant out when it was still cool, that's not necessarily a good thing to do, because it thrives like in, you know, 85 to 90 degree weather. not when it was cooler. So, you know, insects like plants.
Yep.
They eat plants, so it was probably some sort of slug action. And
start over?
Yeah, start over.
Okay.
Uh-huh. All right, one more. This one's from Sandy. I live in Crescent Hill, where the houses are close together. There is a strip of land between my house and my neighbor's, and it gets a little sun, maybe an hour a day.
Yep.
All kinds of weeds are there, and it's always a mess. Is there some kind of ground cover we could plant that would crowd everything else out, be low maintenance, and fill in quickly?
Yeah, the first three that come to mind are good old liriope, which does come actually in variegated cultivars, so it's not all just dull green like it can be with a cool little flower. Some sedges are working there, and of course, good old pachysandra. Any of those three, I think, would fill in nicely, but you've got one with pretty blue flowers.
Yeah, my favorite for a tough ground cover that can be in sun or shade is hardy plumbago. Because it's got that nice sort of robust foliage that holds up well, and then it's got those pretty kind of blue, purple blooms later in the summer. So I love hardy, and I think it's an underused plant.
It's a great blue, too.
Yeah.
It's hard to find that blue anywhere else.
Yeah.
If you have a blue question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, the plant story is what's the word? Resurrected.
It's resurrected.
Okay.
And speaking of resurrected, I haven't given you a plant quiz in a while, so
you're
part of this equation, kiddo.
Okay.
Ready for this?
Yeah.
If I were to say to you the word Podophyllum peltatum, would you think it was a town in Greece, a medical procedure to cure foot diseases, or the Mayapple?
The Mayapple.
How'd you guess that?
Because this is a story about plants.
And it's in May. You're getting smarter all the time. Yeah, the word podophyllum comes from the Greek podo, meaning foot, and phylum, meaning leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Or more specifically, back in Greece, a duck's webbed foot, which does kind of look that way. And the word peltatum comes from the Greek for shield because of those large leaves.
Okay.
It's really neat. That resemble kind of a droopy shield over the top of the, the foot, It is a great plant for May. I love to see it out in the woods. You've seen it in great like acres of it, just spread around the forest, and it spreads by rhizomes. And you peek underneath, and there's these leaves, and looks like a frog's umbrella from a kind of a round or a stem underneath there. And there's a waxy white flower in there with a bright yellow stamen that appears in the spring, usually in the month of
May.
You got it.
Does it turn into an apple?
It will. It will produce the May apple, which is a little bitty light yellow at first, and then it turns light green by late summer.
Okay.
It's a mixed bag. The roots and leaves are highly toxic. It's a May apple, until it fully ripens, is also toxic. It's listed on poison lists in hospitals, actually. But the apple, when fully ripe, is supposed to be edible in jellies or jams. You ever eat one? I've never been that hungry myself.
I'd be afraid of it now after it's all toxic otherwise.
But this is more up your alley. The boiled, dried, and powdered root was used by Native Americans who knew what they were doing as yet another laxative and to remove warts and skin cancers, particularly in very private places. How'd they learn that?
I don't know.
Its more magical folklore attributes include being used in a mojo bag to be safe and protected, being sprinkled around the perimeter of some area if you wish to be left alone, and somewhat ironically, having the whole root tucked under the mattress to ensure virility and fertility. It comes, of course, with a poem.
Good.
Let us today, dear listeners, very fondly grapple with the multitasking and prolific mayapple, a plant often found covering the forest floor or leading mourners to the funeral home door. An interesting plant with umbrella-like leaves, whose many uses depend on what one believes. Is it just ornamental, growing there in the shade, its waxy white flower just barely displayed? Or does it offer protection from all that is evil, a trait that sounds both absurd and medieval? Will it help create babies when hidden under the bed, no matter the abilities of the heavy breeders overhead? If you believe all that you hear and some that you've read, you'll become cured, quite pregnant, or wind up quite dead. The one way to tell if from death you're immune is to be out picking May apples sometime in late June.
That's really, really good. It's been a long time.
I know.
It's
just,
really
they just
funny.
Fall out of my diseased mind looking at Kelly.
Very funny, Bob. Good job. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We'll be back for another seasonal show on June 12th. We hope that you will join us then. Thanks.
Homegrown is produced by the perennial Mayflower, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next time for Homegrown on WFPL.
Support for this Homegrown special comes from a generous contribution from Irene and Jack Stewart.